It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes to understand the place you come from, you have to leave for a while. That's what our next guest did. Returning to rural Wisconsin after time away, she turned her camera to a familiar landscape and saw it in a new way. She shares the results in her new book. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? Did you move away? What is it like when you go back to visit? Do you try to capture images, whether it's with a camera or painting or drawing? What do you set your eyes on when you try to convey the idea of living in the rural Midwest? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erin Springer is a photographer based in Menominee, Wisconsin and Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you set the scene for us? Tell us about the landscape, the community you set out to take pictures in by Menominee.
Yeah, so I grew up outside of Menominee. I went to elementary through high school in Colfax, actually. And I moved away in 2011 and went to school in New York City for college. And then, like you said, after living away for a while, about 10 years, I just became increasingly interested and compelled to go home and make some photos. And I started making the work really during the Thanksgiving holiday when my family would come home to do deer hunting and get together. That was kind of our big holiday. So the first photos in the project really came from that period with them. And then it sort of just sparked into kind of its own life and its own world. And I was really fascinated by the way that we could translate emotions by photographing the landscape and people and combining the two. And that's a big part of the book.
And there you are back in, rural Wisconsin outside of Menominee there after spending time in New York City. You were there. You were looking at the scenery. I think it was COVID, the midst of the pandemic. What felt different to you being there and turning your camera on this place that had once been so familiar to you?
Well, I think it still felt very familiar. I think I just had a bit different perspective. I think that, I grew up with a very typical rural upbringing, but in contrast to the urban life that I was sort of living as an adult through my 20s, I sort of realized that living rurally was quite unique, or it can be quite unique, and also seen sort of from an insider, outsider perspective. Because I remember when I first moved away, and I'd come home, it was just kind of every day. It didn't really strike me as, these interesting sort of scenes of, my aunt's, cow roaming around the farmyard or whatever these typical scenes might be. But the more time that I spent away, just the more I saw them from, I guess, for their unique value in a way that I hadn't really realized when I was living there, when I was much younger. So, I don't know. I can't say anything necessarily felt different. I just sort of had a different perspective. And I think I just had grown a lot as a creative person and an artist and was able to sort of translate those thoughts and that realization kind of in a unique way, or sort of distill it through photography.
And when I see art portraying rural life, I think oftentimes it's like, nostalgic. And sometimes it's sort of in the American Gothic, looking at it from a city perspective. I don't see either of those here. I feel like you're showing us life there. Could you talk about how you tried to, it seems like to me anyway, you kind of avoided both of those.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess it wasn't sort of conscious, in trying to avoid one thing or the other. I think my interest in photography stems from documentary work. And I was, as objective as I try to be about certain situations or the way I'm looking at things, I very much feel that my emotions are present and also just a huge part of what translates into the photos and how I feel and look at things. I guess there's not a whole lot of sentimentality or nostalgia, but I think that's inherent almost in a way to every photograph, because it's sort of this external memory and looking at the past, even if it was yesterday, or 5, 10, 20 years ago. But I think I just was really interested in sort of capturing the atmosphere that I felt when I went home, the starkness of the landscape, the way that people interact with it. And sort of the warmth that's present amongst such a cold period, literally the dormant season or the dormant period of the year. I found that tension to be really, really interesting. And I think probably too, just with the edit and the way that it's all put together, it kind of removes you from that sort of nostalgic perspective and gives you more of a maybe straightforward look at it. As much as the emotions are involved and present in it, I think it's a little bit more straightforward than sentimental.
Talking to Erin Springer, photographer. Her new book is Dormant Season, which includes photos from her hometown. Her home community is just outside of Menominee here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of your photos are landscapes, some involve animals, but there are human subjects in them. And I understand some of them are relatives, some of them are not. How was it working with family and community members here?
Yeah. So the work started with my immediate family. I was making the photos initially when I would be home for Thanksgiving. And that was sort of just this, there wasn't real specific intention. That's the way I've always sort of interacted and participated in different family events. And I've always been just really compelled to capture the moments with my family. But then this work started growing into something that I felt was much bigger and should and could be expanded into the community. And, the more time I spent with my family in sort of familiar settings, the more curious I was about foreign settings, even if it was just, neighbors next door. You don't really realize how many times you might drive by a farm or see somebody in a town nearby that you don't know. And, without approaching them or literally knocking on their door, you may never know about them or their life. And I really, I learned a lot from people that I would approach sort of at random. And it's definitely different challenges working with family versus community, and strangers, but, everybody that's in this work, I've developed a personal relationship with that I think will kind of carry on throughout my life. So I feel really, really fortunate for everybody that had their open doors to me. It's just amazing, like how many different situations you can get in when you just let your curiosity sort of steer the way and follow your instincts and approach people. And, most often people are open and curious as well. Even if they're not familiar with the type of photography that I was interested in making, we had that sort of mutual interest in each other and what I was trying to do. And for me, how they were living and who they are. So, it worked out really well. I feel really, really fortunate to have worked with the people that I did and encountered in very unexpected ways.
I want to visit a couple of the photos here, and I'm looking at one right now, and this is selfish. I didn't grow up on the family farm, grew up visiting my great uncle's family farm, fond memories of time in the hayloft. And you've got a picture, a bunch of kids, it's almost set up like an amphitheater in the hayloft there. Can you tell us a little bit about that image?
Yeah. So I guess to describe the picture a bit, the group of kids are hanging out in the hayloft, which is the upper level of a barn, for anybody that might not be familiar. And there's two boys hanging from the rafters, and there's other kids and a cat seated on top of some stacked hay bales. And they're all talking amongst themselves. Nobody's making direct eye contact. And we're sort of just enveloped by this, amphitheater, like you said. When I first saw that scene, I thought, wow, this is like a cathedral. the light is streaming in and, the light's reflected from the particles in the hay and the air. I got to this image. It actually was a pretty long buildup to this because I was with my uncle and my cousin who were loading soybeans at this farm just a year prior. And I'd always driven, this is kind of the perfect classic example of what I was saying earlier, where I was always driving by this farm and I knew of the family that lived there, but I'd never actually been to the farm. So I went with my uncle and my cousin and just to spend time with them. And there was a bunch of kids running around the farmyard and, just struck up conversation with one of the teenagers. And I learned that there's a one-room school there with 15 or so kids, ages 6 to about 17, so every grade. And, within that conversation, I talked to the farmer that lives there, and his daughter has the school. And he told me that it was actually my great, great, great grandfather that built that barn. So I just thought, wow, like this is so how, you know, the things you learn just by asking a few questions. And, you know, this was only 5 miles from where I grew up, but I hadn't known that prior to that visit. So I sort of took that as a sign and I started spending time at the school the following year. I was really thinking about this, you know, I think I was on my way back to New York when I first met the kids at the school, and I was there on that initial visit with my uncle. But yeah, I really just kind of took this as a sign, and I was so curious about this. I just really wanted to explore what the school was like too. Just like the fact that there was kids learning on a school was, or sorry, learning on a farm was really interesting. So yeah, then I just went back the following fall and spent a lot of time with the kids, and that photo was made on their sort of recess lunch break. It was cold outside and they spend time in the barn and play with the kitties, and that was sort of where they congregate. And yeah, we just had a lot of fun, and I made that picture of them, and just really, yeah, it was a really special experience for me. And I really am really glad for that moment in that photo.
We're talking to photographer Erin Springer about her new book. It's called Dormant Season, which captures life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see beauty in rural Wisconsin life? The people, the places, the buildings, the landscapes. Do you try to capture those through photos or drawing or painting or writing? Do you have a favorite artist who portrays what life is like in the rural Midwest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with photographer Erin Springer about her new book, Dormant Season, a collection of photos of life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you try to catch images of rural Wisconsin on camera or painting or drawing or whatever you might do, love to hear from you what you like to draw. Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota, who said, aside from loving living in a rural part of his state, he thinks the windmill is a great icon of rural landscape. I don't think you have windmills, Erin, but something that really kind of looms over the scenery a lot is the silo. I see that showing up in a few pictures, and that gives, I don't know, it gives like a height to some of the pictures. Could you talk about how you tried to bring silos into? I'm looking at one right now, actually, with some birds doing a flyby.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really, I hadn't intentionally sort of thought about the incorporation of silos, but maybe there's a subconscious thread there of sort of the storage of memory. Maybe there's something there about, you know, the storage of crops that go into silos throughout the winter. And sort of this project is a sort of container of my memories and expression of my memories. Maybe that's a stretch, but if I had to give a top of mind answer, that might be something going on in my inner mind there.
I love it. We've got Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Well, hello, good afternoon. I've done the similar thing, moved away and came back. And what I found as I recall these memories, and I wanted to ask the artist here, as part of the creative process that goes into taking a photograph or a scene, does music play a part? Or even after you produce the photograph later, do certain songs remind you of certain scenes? Or as part of the creative process, how does music affect what you do?
Interesting question. Ooh. Jeff. Erin, what do you think?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question. I actually was listening to a song on repeat kind of while I was making this work, and I was really listening to a lot of classical music, a lot of piano and a lot of cello. And I spent so much time just driving around by myself in the landscape and the openness of the sort of winter fields and sky. And I found the classical music to be really really helpful in sort of getting me into a zone of emotion and mood, and also kind of just creating a canvas for me to look at things without having words placed upon them. So the classical music I was listening to was all instrumental. And I thought that that was really, it really was moving to me to, you know, watch snow drifting across the road, watching wind, watching just people from a distance while listening to music that has such, such big crescendos and everything. I thought it was really, really helpful for me, but I hadn't really thought about it as part of the process. I think it was sort of, again, just like a subconscious thing that I would do when I would think of it, and I would sort of need another spark, you know, to get me into a mindset to make photos or feel a certain type of way.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. I can't leave it hanging, Aaron. What song were you listening to on repeat in particular?
I knew you were going to ask, and I need to, hold on. Let me pull this up here. Let's see. I've got my, I can never remember the name. It's one that I hadn't heard before I sort of put on a shuffle in classical music here. I've got a playlist. Sorry for the
here. Was it actually just building the suspense for me? I don't know about anybody else.
I know. Here it is. Okay. It's by Anya Lechner, and it's called Vague, and then it's / En la Nave Va. And it's from her album Lontano.
All right, we're gonna get a link on our segment note for that. Aaron, as we wrap up, just briefly, one thing that really strikes me, you put the photos in the book, you don't have captions, you don't have descriptions. What led to that decision, just letting those photos stand for themselves?
Well, I think it's important for viewers to have their own interpretation of the work. I think what you feel and what you glean from a body of visual work is as relevant as what maybe the artist did making it. And so I just really, the mystery of it and the openness and the all the different forms that it can take on and the spaces that it can occupy in your mind, if you aren't overly explicative with things and you don't explain what's necessarily happening, I think can be really helpful for a visual project like this. You know, it's not specific to one person, one place, or even one story. It's really to evoke a feeling and convey sort of a more generalized mood. So I think that that's, I think not having captions and not having explanations is helpful for that.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Springer, a photographer based in Menominee here in Wisconsin and Brooklyn, the New York kind of Brooklyn, not our Wisconsin Brooklyn. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. She was with us to talk about her new photo book, Dormant Season, with lots of pictures of places, people, and landscape near Menominee. More than 20,000 people living in Wisconsin have cases pending in immigration court that could result in deportation. But the vast majority of those people won't be represented by a lawyer. As Sarah Lear reports, there's a growing and unmet demand for immigration attorneys in Wisconsin and across the country.
On a recent spring afternoon, more than 30 people file into the basement of a church in Madison. Some carry babies in strollers and slings. They settle into plastic chairs as attorney Aisa Olivares of the Community Immigration Law Center cues up a slideshow. The people in the crowd are new arrivals to the U.S. Some are seeking asylum. That means they need to prove they left their home countries because they fear persecution for characteristics like their race or their politics. They typically have a year to turn in government paperwork. The form must be completed in English. And the process often involves recounting trauma, like imprisonment, sexual assault, or torture. They need help. But with only 3 attorneys on staff, the center doesn't have the resources to give one-on-one legal advice to everyone. Paralegal Diana Benitez says the nonprofit has no choice but to turn many people away.
It's desperate. It's just the level of desperation people have when they come to speak with you is just really... it's palpable. It's just, you can see it on your face.
In 2019, there were more than 1 million pending U.S. immigration cases. Today, that backlog has surpassed 3 million. Sue Long directs the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which analyzed the federal data. She says insufficient court funding is partly to blame.
They haven't had the budget to increase the number of immigration judges and support staff that are needed to hold hearings and make decisions, compared to increasing the budget, for example, for the Border Patrol.
And when immigrants end up in court, data also shows they're less likely to have lawyers. 5 years ago, immigrants nationwide had legal representation in 65% of pending deportation cases. Now, only 30% do. In the U.S., criminal defendants have a right to an attorney, but that right does not apply to immigration cases. Annie Chen is with the Vera Institute of Justice, a left-leaning think tank. She says the system has created an imbalance.
The government is always represented by a trained attorney, but the immigrant is often in immigration court alone.
When immigrants have attorneys, studies show they're more likely to be released on bond if they're detained. They're also less likely to be deported. Barb Graham oversees refugee and immigration legal services for Catholic Charities in Milwaukee. It's one of a handful of organizations in Wisconsin that handles immigration cases on a free or pro bono basis. Graham says her clients can't afford to pay thousands of dollars for complicated and lengthy cases.
People who are applying for asylum have left everything. They come up with nothing. They have no access to money. They have no access to, they didn't come with their bank account.
But even when people can afford to pay, Graham says private immigration attorneys can be in short supply. Border Patrol encounters with migrants at the southern border reached a record high last year. And Milwaukee immigration attorney Teddy Chadwick says demand for his services has risen exponentially.
I have court hearings that are scheduled out until 2028 and 2029.
Faced with a backlog, Chadwick says there's often nothing immigrants or asylum seekers can do to make their cases go faster. And he says those cases can be all but impossible to navigate without an attorney. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. The Human Genome Project released the first full sequence of a complete human gene 20 years ago. And along with the project came the potential for a new kind of medical treatment called personal medicine or precision medicine. The hope was that we could have unique treatments tailored to our genetic profiles. That hope came with a lot of hype. But our guest says, in reality, genetic differences have proven to be small factors in a lot of major illnesses, things like asthma or Parkinson's. And when personalized medicine has been effective, the cost for treatment can be ruinous for patients. But he says there's an even deeper problem. Funding has gone toward this kind of genetic medicine research and away from environmental causes of disease that could lead to more cost-effective prevention efforts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you familiar with this idea of personalized or precision medicine? Have you or someone you know or loved one had one of these treatments? Was it effective? Was it expensive? Do you have questions about the hopes for this medicine and what we might have lost in pursuing it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Tabry is a professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene: Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
I laid out the basics of the initial hopes for personalized medicine or precision medicine. Can you talk a little more about what we meant by those phrases at the outset?
Yeah, you nailed it. You know, the personalized medicine motto is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. And it's really intentionally designed to be a contrast with what's often chided as the traditional one-size-fits-all approach to medicine. And so the idea is, on traditional medicine, you know, if two patients have diabetes or if 1,000 patients have diabetes, they're all treated the same. But when we take the genomic differences between us into consideration, then that will no longer be the case. One patient with diabetes will get one treatment plan based on their particular genetic profile. Another patient will get a different one. And the promise there, that, you know, the vision was that personalization, that ability to get down to the precise causes of problems, was going to just sort of be a revolution across healthcare.
We'll get into some of the problems with the way that came out, but a really fundamental story in your book is your concern that this quest for these personalized medicines, these genomics-based medicines, took away from research into environmental health. Literally, at one point, basically two different pieces of research pitted against each other at the federal level. Can you talk about that part, that aspect of the threat to public health that you see in personalized medicine?
Yeah, the thread that runs through the whole book is this story about two efforts that were undertaken at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. That's really the, you know, the agency that's the crown jewel of biomedical research for the United States. And after the Human Genome Project wrapped up in 2003, there were two different efforts to try to launch a nationwide study of health in America. One of those was called the National Children's Study, and that was going to be an effort to recruit 100,000 children from across the United States. One of the first recruitment centers was actually going to be based, focused on Waukesha County in Wisconsin. And it was very much going to be focused on the environmental contributions to health and illness, and basically tracking children from before they were born until they were adults, collecting all this information about the environmental exposures that they had, and then looking for how that contributed to who got sick and who didn't later in life. The other effort was, again, focused on collecting data from people all over the United States. That was going to be focused much more on genetic contributions to health and illness, getting blood, getting some basic measurements from folks at the beginning, and then just sort of looking to see who gets sick later in life and then hook up those genetic differences with the differences in health outcomes. And they were really in a kind of competition to see who was going to come to life. We can sort of dive into the details as much as you want later, but the long story short was in December 2014, the National Children's Study was ultimately terminated. And in January 2015, a month later, President Obama announced in his State of the Union address what was came to be called the All of Us Research Project, and that was that genomics effort. So the book sort of looks at what were the factors, the financial factors, the social factors, the scientific factors, the technological factors that inclined the National Institutes of Health to lean in the direction of this genomic study rather than the environmental one. And the argument of the book is that these are forces that are all across the United States. And so, in fact, we're seeing something, a pivot towards genetics and healthcare generally.
Talking to James Tabry about his new book, The Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Will joins us now in Oconomowoc. Will, hi.
Hey there. My dad had prostate cancer and it metastasized to his liver. When that happened, they started personalizing his treatment based on his genetics, and I don't know very much about it. I experienced it as he was experiencing it, and he in the end passed away. So I don't know if it helped him or if it just prolonged kind of a downward spiral, but I'm really interested in the topic. Thanks.
And Will, actually, before I let you go, first, I'm sorry for the loss of your dad. Do you know, do you have any sense of how much it cost along the way, or were those things covered?
Cost was immense. I'm from California, and the state picked up a large portion of the bill because he's an older man. He passed away at 79, and he was retired, and I'm sure that his bills were a lot.
Will, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know you can relate. You start your book with the story of your own father in personalized medicine.
Yeah, thanks so much for that call, Will. I had the exact same thought, Rob. The introductory chapter is basically my experience with this, and it was very similar to what Will just said, which was I encountered it by way of my father's experience with cancer. He was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in 2011. He was given a drug, one of the early drugs that were really hailed as kind of one of these breakthrough treatments in personalized medicine. It was a drug called Tarceva for patients with lung cancer. For every indication, he did live a longer life. The life expectancy for somebody with stage 4 lung cancer at that time was about 8 months. My father was on Tarceva. He lived for about 13 months. So, as Will said, it was a lot of money. It did not cure him. It probably kept him around for a little while longer. In the end, I wish he didn't have lung cancer. And the story about the prevention of lung cancer is not one about the genes in our bodies. It's about making the air that we breathe more lung friendly, whether that's with smoking cessation programs or radon remission programs or asbestos abatement programs. The real progress in the downward trend of lung cancer diagnoses over the last few decades has not been genomic medicine. It's about making the environments that we live in much, much healthier.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Jim, some conditions that I think we had hopes for early on in genomic research were very common and growing problems like asthma and Parkinson's disease. As researchers tried to find genetic ties to those particular widespread conditions, what did they find?
That the genetics were far more complicated than they anticipated. I think it's helpful to contrast it. There certainly are conditions which are largely genetic in nature. There's a number of rare disorders, thinking about things like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, sickle cell, where the genetic cause of the problem, the basic mechanisms responsible for it, have long been known. Those have lent themselves to genetic interventions, and we can talk about that later. It creates different problems of economics, but at least the biological plausibility is there. When you shift to the conditions that are taking the largest toll on most people, you mentioned asthma, Parkinson's, diabetes, heart disease, a variety of cancers. Those things are, from a genetic perspective, enormously complicated. There's not just one or a handful of genes. In many cases, there's tens, dozens, hundreds, even thousands of regions in the genome that are implicated in those conditions, along with all sorts of environmental contributions. And so what happens with those far more complicated traits is it just becomes that much more difficult to get any sort of purchase that you could then use to develop some sort of personalized medicine. And in turn, the progress on those fronts has been far more limited than in contrast to things like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell disease.
So in the conclusion for your book, I think you're making the case pretty strongly that if we want to tackle something like asthma, probably funding gene research isn't going to help. What would you like to see targeted instead?
We're going to get the most bang for our buck out of making the environments that we live in safer. And that's both doing the research that identifies the things that are making us sick. It's also, and that's kind of traditional environmental research. Think of sort of, focus on toxins, air quality, which population of kids have access to what air. There's all sorts of research about different communities getting exposed to different environmental toxins. And so that's a part of that as well. The other side of it, of course, is also social behavioral research and research about intervention. So even though we know, city like Salt Lake City, where I live, the air quality is often very, very bad. But there's a big jump from recognizing that bad air quality is associated with a spike in asthma admittances into the hospital and coming up with interventions that can then alter that problem. And so I think, the focus has to be on making the environment safer and developing the resource so that we can navigate an environment that isn't always safe.
We're talking to Professor James Tabry from the University of Utah about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests based on what you've heard so far? What do you think about the idea of healthcare shifting to look more at our genetic profiles, moving away from environmental factors? Would you like to reverse that, as our guest would? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. We're talking to James Tabry from the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the idea of personalized medicine, environmental public health efforts that may have been funded less because of the focus on genes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jim, you mentioned earlier there are success stories where, yes, we're able to develop medications that work for people with more easily identifiable genetic causes of their conditions. But the costs, you write about that. Not only are they expensive to begin with, unlike a lot of medications, they seem to go up over time.
That's exactly right, Rob. The sort of poster child of personalized medicine was a drug called Gleevec. And it became the poster child in part because it was so successful and it came out quite early. So this was a drug that was approved by the FDA in 2001. That's right when the Human Genome Project is wrapping up. And so folks looking for, you know, something to point to as an example of this personalized medicine working were naturally drawn to Gleevec. It was a treatment for a particular form of blood cancer for chronic myelogenous leukemia. About 5,000 to 10,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with it a year. And prior to 2001, life expectancy was quite poor. The chances of living more than 5 years after that diagnosis was very low. Now, when patients are diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, they can live for 10 or more years easily. And it's in part because of drugs like Gleevec and a series of others that have come along after it that are very effective at treating this cancer. But it came at a cost and in really frightening ways. When the drug was first approved, it cost about $2,000 to $3,000 a month. And so we're talking about $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And what happened was Novartis, the drug company that manufactured the drug, in the ensuing years, rather than having those costs come down as more and more patients were able to take it, and then in turn as more competitors came online to offer drugs that work similarly, the cost of it kept going up. And in fact, by the time that generics for Gleevec were finally available in 2016, the price of that drug had gone from about $20,000 to $30,000 a year to close to $150,000 a year. And there was this outcry from the chronic myelogenous leukemia patients and their families, as well as the researchers, saying that this is just unsustainable. And in fact, what we find is when you look across the board for these medications that are developed in this manner, they are oftentimes extremely expensive, sometimes in the millions of dollars, which creates all sort of access problems for the people who need it most.
Let's go back to our callers with Will in Madison. Will, hello.
Hi, hello. I have something that's concerning connected to genetic research. Yes, I would like to participate in the genetic research of all of us knowing about it. However, I have not participated particularly in the genetic research because I have two parents who both had Alzheimer's and passed mm-hmm. with it. And my concern then is, what if that if I were to participate and that information were then exposed? Here is information potentially about me, and then it's made public. What does that do to my health care costs? What does that do to my insurance? Well, you know, this is very concerning. Once we get into genetics, if this may potentially be my future.
Well, thanks for the call. Jim, what do you think?
That's a great question, Will, and thanks for being willing to share it. I think the first thing to say is back in 2008, the federal government did pass something called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And so, at least legally in theory, you cannot be discriminated against based on that genetic information when it comes to things like employment, housing, and health insurance. Now, there's sort of mixed reviews out there about how successful this is at protecting the people that need to be protected. But at least, again, in theory, the thought was we don't want people to be discriminated against based on that information. I think, though, the point that Will raises is a really important one, particularly with regards to a terribly scary condition like Alzheimer's disease. You know, the vision at the end of the Human Genome Project was We're going to find the genes for these traits. We're going to then know the cause of them. And then that's going to pave the way for all sorts of biomedical interventions to make these problems go away so that we don't have to face those scary realities that some patients may be facing. Alzheimer's disease is just a classic example of one where there are some genes that are known to increase the risk of having it. But treatments for it have largely been wanting. You know, there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease yet. And so we are at a really awkward place now in, with some of these traits where genetic sources of the problems have been found, but the then interventions that are supposed to make them go away are not available. And that creates the kind of problem that Will was just describing, where you might find yourself in a situation where you're torn about whether or not to get this information, because it's not like getting it will necessarily pave the way to a solution. It's just sort of creates the opportunity for all sorts of anxiety about the fact that you could have this thing and not have an obvious route towards preventing it.
Thanks for the call, Will. Talking to James Tabry about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Let's go now to Tom in Milwaukee. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering if one could extend the question of looking at environmental factors into aspects of political decisions, such as during the Trump administration, a lot of the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations were nullified, or protections for OSHA, for workers. These are political decisions. It's not necessarily a question of where to direct research so much as just maintaining the protections we should already have.
Tom, thanks for the call. Jim, you tackle that in the book. You point out, as Tom does, there's bipartisan disagreement over things like environmental protections and workplace safety. But this personalized medicine, people across the aisle seem to be able to work together on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm so glad that Tom raised that. You know, the subtitle of the book is Personalized Medicine, Its Threat to Public Health. I think that, you know, one of the points I want to make clear is I don't think there's anything necessarily intrinsic to this genomic medicine that threatens public health. Rather, the idea is that there are all these sort of forces at play that are blowing into the wind of the sails of personalized medicine, which simultaneously tend to work against focus on researching public health. And the political landscape that Tom brought up is a perfect example of that. When you look at focusing on the environment and environmental research generally, environmental health, the environmental contributions to health and illness, it is a very politicized phenomenon, right? I mean, you've got one political party where people that are trying to run for president are vowing to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, that's sort of how politicized it's become. And so it's a hot button issue. When you switch over to personalized medicine, genomic medicine, precision medicine, blue, red, you name it, across the political spectrum, political leaders love the idea of launching an initiative where they're promising to cure cancer or make kids with rare diseases live longer lives. It's one of those things that in our very polarized day and age is a place where Democrats and Republicans tend to unite. And so that's another one of these reasons that you can see all this attention and effort going into it, is because it's a spot where the political tension just isn't as fraught as it is on the environmental side.
Tom, thanks for that call. And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's James Tabry, professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health, Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. Talk to him today about his new book. It's called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about poetry and farming.
The poetry in Daniel Smith's book, Ancestral, reflects on life and farming in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. WPR's Tim Peterson spoke with him about his poetry on an early spring day in his barn near Arena, Wisconsin. Smith shared three poems about heritage, loss, and an appreciation for the wild.
I thought I would start with a poem called Anvil, which deals with the move to this land that we are standing on this morning and leaving our ancestral home, a farm in northwestern Illinois. Anvil. I've hauled my father's anvil due north, up out of the black Illinois farm ground. He and I together worked decades our home. Set down 60 pounds onto the floor of this old barn, new only to me. All around, our bewildered tools hang in the strange light of the cracked window pane, where I stand looking out over land not yet home. It is growing late on a late winter's day. At my feet, my father's anvil, his striking song of steel on steel, still hammering home. This next poem is about a neighbor of mine who passed away several years ago. A man had welcomed us to our new home here in Wisconsin and then suddenly became ill and passed away. And it's called A Farmer Dies in Springtime. Home from the hospital to a bed with a view of the fields. Tended by hospice, who arrive morning and night like a hired man come to chore. Neighbors stop by, sit bedside, stare into their hands, red and cracked from winter. They recall the year of the early frost, flood, or big drought. They avoid talk of the plowing or planting, of the futures for cattle or corn. The tractor, disc, and planter stay locked in the shed with seed bought months ago when the new catalogs arrived, glossy with promise and primed for a year that would not be. Now that I have grandchildren, one of my inspirations for writing is to share things with them that I hope they'll read when they get older, and that they still live in a world that gives them beauty and an appreciation of nature. One day while I was walking, I came across a red fox, which is rare to find in the open, and I wrote this poem for my grandchildren called The Red Fox. I saw a red fox drinking from the horse pail in the pasture south of the barn. A winter sunset blazed upon his hide, and his black ears pointed toward the early stars. Suddenly aware, he bolted for the dark woods, but I did not follow. It was enough to know he exists, to know this world still shelters the rare and the wild.
Daniel Smith is a poet and president and CEO of Cooperative Network. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, Wisconsin is an outlier when it comes to alcohol, with higher rates of drinking and of binge drinking than the country as a whole. During the pandemic, alcohol-related deaths spiked here in Wisconsin, as they did around the country. But even before the pandemic, Wisconsin had a long-running upward trend in deaths caused by alcohol. almost tripling the rate from roughly 7 per 100,000 people in 1999 to 19 by 2020. Federal surveys have also consistently found that Wisconsinites are among the least likely to consider binge drinking a risky behavior. Our next guest joins us for a look at dangerous drinking, why it's such a problem in the state, and what it means for our health. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Wisconsin's drinking culture? Whether you've lived here all your life or you moved here from somewhere else, do you notice different attitudes toward drinking and toward binge drinking in Wisconsin compared to other places? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maureen Buzalaki is the director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with binge drinking. In 2019, about a third of Wisconsin adults reported binge drinking in the previous month, second highest in the nation after North Dakota at that time. Can you tell us more about that number and what we mean by binge drinking?
Sure. Binge drinking is 4 drinks in a 2-hour period for women and 5 drinks in a 2-hour period for men. And the reason why we say that is because then you're at 0.08. the legal limit. So I don't think folks necessarily understand, how alcohol affects them and how much. And excessive alcohol use not only includes binge drinking, but also heavy drinking, which is considered 1 to 2 drinks a day, drinking while pregnant, and underage drinking. In terms of excessive alcohol use, every county in the state of Wisconsin has a higher rate of drinking than the national average. We're the only state where every county is above the national average.
Can you talk about some of the health consequences of our excessive drinking?
Yes, there's many. There's fully attributable deaths, including cardiomyopathy, liver disease, which I think a lot of us associate with fetal alcohol syndrome, and many others. And then there are acute deaths like alcohol poisoning, suicide, other kinds of injury-related deaths, with motor vehicle crashes, falls, suicide, homicide, firearms, aspiration, drowning, fire, hypothermia, and I could go on. And then chronic deaths associated with, partially attributable to alcohol, which is cancer for the mouth, throat, larynx, esophagus, larynx, breast, liver, and colon, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, pneumonia, and seizure disorders, to name a few.
I've had a lot of conversations over the years tackling the question, why Wisconsin? Why this focus on alcohol, particularly in Wisconsin? I've heard a lot of different answers floated and dismissed. What are some of your thoughts on that, Maureen?
Well, we have an interesting history. We weren't always like this. We had a number of leaders in the temperance movement. So we have kind of a varied history. In the last 20 years, we've seen Wisconsin policies change to allow alcohol in more and more places. In other places, it's not common to have alcohol in gas stations and certainly not cold or single serving, in gas stations. We find it at pretty much every event, it seems like. There's almost anything, even music festivals that are geared towards families and kids often will have alcohol with them. And then we are pretty liberal with our licensure. So we allow a lot of alcohol retail and bars and restaurants. And in other states, you've got like 1 alcohol license per 3,000 people in New Jersey or 1 to 1,500 in Idaho. In Wisconsin, the average is 1 for 354 people.
I want to get back to some of the consequences now, Maureen. And I think it may be hard to see this from within Wisconsin. When we stack up alcohol health consequences and compare them to the rest of the country, you mentioned that that county by county average, which is pretty striking. What are some of the other ways this shows up in Wisconsin's health consequences from alcohol being worse than the rest of the country?
So we have a very high number of liver transplants. you know, in comparison to other states, you know, based on our size. So that's certainly, and there's a number of healthcare consequences to the excessive alcohol use that we have in our state. So there's a number of injuries. We often think about motor vehicle injuries, but there's many others. We have very significant number of falls, you know, every year that are attributable to alcohol, you know, in the 500 range, which I think if you think about that, that's really high. And we lead the nation overall, as I understand it, in falls. You know, and so alcohol definitely contributes to that number.
We're talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health consequences of our heavy drinking in the state. Maureen Buzalaki is with us, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at possible policy alternatives. You could join in. What do you think could be done to address high rates of binge drinking in Wisconsin, heavy drinking overall? What support do people struggling with alcoholism need? What are barriers to getting help? Are there changes you'd like to see related to alcohol in your own community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin, about why Wisconsin has among the highest rates of binge drinking in the nation, the health consequences of that, and what policy alternatives could be on the table. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin's culture affects alcohol consumption? Are there changes you'd like to see in state or maybe local law and regulations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maureen, let's get into public policy now. Are there changes that, say, other states have made that have helped them move in a better direction that maybe we could learn from here in Wisconsin?
Yes, for sure. The State Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse released a report on excessive alcohol and what policies could be helpful, and they named 61 recommendations. And so they range from things that can be done in civic organizations, for example. You know, if there's an organization hosting a fundraiser of some sort, perhaps not serving alcohol or, you know, being very limited in how much alcohol is being served to send a message, right, in terms of the culture in the community. Looking at local government, there's a number of things they can do with alcohol licensing, you know, to make sure that we don't exceed how many licenses that we want in a population, you know, looking maybe at around schools and thinking about, you know, how much do we want people to see as they're walking to school? You know, so there's a number of different kinds of things that they can think about. Now, you have to be careful with licensing to make sure that you're being, you know, even-handed and handling every license the same. But there are definitely things that can be done, especially with festivals, for example, you know, and making sure that if there's alcohol served, that it is in, as you know, a separate area, that people are being checked for the ID, and again, that they're not over-serving the patrons.
I think a lot of times when we talk about alcohol abuse, we look at individual solutions, whether that's, you know, a character flaw of the person, or we need to focus more on treatment, and treatment is important, of course. Do you think we pay enough attention to bigger picture, community and policy stuff?
We have communities all over the state that are making a lot of changes and, you know, really looking at the alcohol environment. But I would say overall, I think there's a lot more that we could do on the local level in terms of making sure that we have, you know, an understanding of how much alcohol is costing a community, you know, and how, you know, really looking at some of the data from law enforcement and understanding how many of those calls for service are alcohol related. And I think when people understand some of the costs, that can be helpful. The same can be true with, you know, health systems and understanding that, and then making decisions on, you know, how dense do we want alcohol outlets? We know there's violence associated with clustering of retail outlets, you know, liquor stores and those kinds of places. So really thinking ahead about, you know, what is it that we want for our community, and making some of those kinds of changes.
Let's bring on a caller. Patty is with us in Hayward. Patty, hello.
Hi. I just had a comment. I just recently moved to Wisconsin, and I'm definitely seeing, I'm retired. I just am definitely seeing like the drinking culture. Well, a few years ago, I was at a festival that was trying to raise money for the program I was involved in, and they were going to be serving alcohol. So I reluctantly agreed, but I'm kind of glad I did it because we had to have some training. And the police officer told me, or told us, that the people that were getting the most DUIs that he was seeing were men that were going off to work in the morning because they had been drinking in the evening, kind of had a high tolerance to it, but still were testing higher. So anyway, that really struck me because I know several people like this. And so I started carrying a breathalyzer around with me. And I don't know, that has seemed to make a difference to people because a lot of these guys are just stunned by how high they still are.
So you, I'm sorry, Patty, you breathalyze your friends and acquaintances? Do they go for that?
Yeah, why not? Why not? You know what? Because my son-in-law got a DUI for going 45 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. And my daughter's like, Mom, he seemed okay. He was great. I'm like, well, you until you see the numbers, you think you're okay, you know? So some people are just barely over. I had one drink the other day, and I was already at a 0.05 because I'm very small. So, yeah, bring it with me. I offer it because I think that the stats speak louder than words.
Patty, thanks a lot for the call. Maureen, Patty sees the difference here in Wisconsin. She's working to do something about it all by herself. What do you think?
Well, I think that's an interesting approach for sure. I know some places, you know, have those breathalyzers, you know, and I think part of it is that people need to know what a serving size is. So they might think they're having one drink, but they're actually having two. Or if it's, you know, there are Elko Pops, there are, we call them kind of a binge drink in a can. So it can be a large can of White Claw or Four Loko, for example, and they can contain 2 to 4 to 5 even drinks. And so your blood alcohol level can get very high very quickly while you're drinking that. So really paying attention to what is a serving size and really looking at how many you're having. And you know, the CDC has a campaign, be your best, you know, drink less, be your best.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health impacts of it, possible changes to fix it, with Maureen Buzlaki with the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, I mentioned briefly a treatment earlier for people who recognize, hey, I'm drinking too much, whether it's binge or chronic drinking. I don't seem to be able to fix this myself. Do we have treatment out there for them when they need it?
I mean, there is treatment in many parts of the state, but I can't say universally that it's easily available. It kind of depends on where you are. We now look at it as an alcohol use disorder and that there are, you know, kind of a spectrum of that. And so trying to think about, you know, yourself and how you are with drinking and, you know, are you not having the relationship you want, might be a good idea to talk to a healthcare provider. The CDC website also has, you know, kind of a quick quiz to help you also think about that, because it's, you know, sometimes it's not that you have an alcohol use disorder, but that you're, you know, frequently binge drinking and, you know, you can get into a lot of trouble with that. And so it's important to try to work on that early. So if you think you're having, an issue, you should probably talk to somebody very quickly. And I would always recommend healthcare as a first step.
In just our last minute or so, Maureen, back in the day, I talked to you when you were with Smoke-Free Wisconsin. We've seen the number of smokers in the U.S. Drop by about half for over a 16-year or so period. Are there lessons from public health smoking campaigns that you think could apply to alcohol?
I do. I think there's a combination of really building public awareness, having strong policy, and really having kind of that cross sector where you're working with public health, you're working with health systems, you know, law enforcement, Department of Transportation, and others.
Maureen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She talked to us today about Wisconsin's high rates of binge drinking and other alcohol problems, the health consequences, possible policy solutions. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts on this issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.